Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Politicians brace for a runoff election in Tunisia. Gunmen open fire in a Nigerian market. I'm Dave DeForest reporting from Washington. The AFP reports politicians in Tunisia are planning for a runoff election even before the results are announced from the first round of elections. Tunisians are waiting for the final tally from the first election since the Arab Spring uprising. The leading candidate for president, Beji Caid Essebsi, is expected to fall short of the needed 50% to win. He will likely face a runoff against incumbent Moncef Marzouki. Gunmen opened fire today on a crowded market in northeastern Nigeria, according to a military officer quoted by the AFP news service. The shooting by suspected Boko Haram gunmen began at about 11 a.m. local time. The attack took place in Damask in Borno State near the border with Niger. The death toll was not immediately known. Tanzania's president says he will not kick the Maasai people off their ancestral lands. The AFP reports activists had feared that the government would take the land for use as a hunting reserve for the wealthy. The Maasai land borders the Serengeti National Park. Officials in Madagascar are scrambling to prevent an outbreak of plague. AFP reports that the disease has already killed about 40 people and is believed to be spreading. According to the Associated Press, the president of Liberia is urging her countrymen to step up efforts to rid the nation of Ebola by Christmas. The goal is believed by experts to be very ambitious. Liberia has had about 3,000 confirmed, probable, or suspected deaths from the Ebola disease since the outbreak began. This is VOA News. Burkina Faso's military has held on to powerful posts in a new cabinet unveiled on Sunday, 3 weeks after the army took over following a popular revolt. Lieutenant Colonel Isaac Zida will remain prime minister and also take on the office of defense minister. The military likewise will have control of four other ministries: interior, territorial administration, sports, environment, and mines. Interim President Michel Kafando will also function as foreign minister. Flooding in Morocco has taken the lives of dozens of people. Many people were caught up in the floods that swept away buildings and washed out roads in the southern part of the country. Reuters says Morocco's King Mohammed has given orders for the authorities to take, quoting now, all necessary emergency measures to help and support victims of the floods. Flash floods are common in Morocco. Iranian and Western diplomats say talks between Iran and six leading nations on nuclear issues will continue until at least July 1st. The diplomats spoke in Vienna as a self-imposed deadline on reaching a comprehensive agreement approached. Diplomats now say they will try to have a framework agreement ready by March 1st, outlining progress made and identifying points still to be resolved. A final accord could be reached 3 months later. Here is U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry.
We believe a comprehensive deal that addresses the world's concerns is possible. It is desirable. And at this point, we have developed a clearer understanding of what that kind of deal could look like. But there are still some significant points of disagreement, and they have to be worked through.
Negotiators want guarantees that Iran's nuclear program will be used only for peaceful purposes. U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel has resigned after nearly 2 years in the position. President Barack Obama, speaking at the White House, said the defense secretary told him last month it was time for him to complete his service.
There's one thing I know about Chuck, it's that he does not make this or any decision lightly. This decision does not come easily to him, but I consider myself extraordinarily lucky to have had him by my side for 2 years, and I am grateful that Chuck has agreed to stay on until I nominate his successor.
Mr. Obama called Hagel a steady hand in helping his administration respond to the challenges of Ebola and the Islamic State. Russia's finance minister says Russia is losing more than $100 billion a year due to Western sanctions and falling oil prices. Anton Sulunov said today at an economic forum in Moscow, Russia could lose as much as $40 billion per year because of Western sanctions. I'm Dave DeForest.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib. And coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight...
Somali militant group Al-Shabaab is denying Kenya's claim that its forces have killed more than 100 Al-Shabaab fighters. Kenya says it's launched raids along the Somali border after Al-Shabaab attacked a base in northeastern Kenya, killing 28 people. There is anger towards the government for failing to protect Kenyans from their militants.
That's Mohamed Yusuf reporting from Nairobi. Details coming up.
Also in the news, President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf has called on all Liberians to double their efforts to stop the spread of the Ebola virus. And Burkina Faso's military has held on to powerful posts in a new cabinet unveiled yesterday.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Douglas Mpuga sitting in for Sunny, music from Cameroon, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf has called on all Liberians to double their efforts to stop the spread of the Ebola virus. She's set a goal of no new cases of the disease by Christmas Day. Liberia has recorded almost 3,000 Ebola deaths since the outbreak began. However, the number of new cases in Liberia has declined recently, and the U.S. military has reduced plans for 11 Ebola treatment centers. The director of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Dr. Tom Frieden, says it is urgent that the world fill gaps in health services to avoid another epidemic like the current Ebola outbreak. President Barack Obama has asked the U.S. Congress for $600 million to initiate a global health security agenda. The proposal guards against the next contagion. Recent contagions include the bird flu in Southeast Asia, SARS in China, a 2009 flu pandemic, and MERS in the Middle East. The new recording of Do They Know It's Christmas has reached number one in sales in the UK. 2 weeks ago, musician Bob Geldof gathered British music stars to rework the song that raised millions of dollars for the victims of the Ethiopian famine 30 years ago. Some African musicians have spoken out against the British recording, saying it stigmatizes Africans. Tekin Jaffa Coley of Ivory Coast says the recording evokes pity for Africa.
The military that promised a civilian government in Burkina Faso is playing a leading role in the new interim government, in spite of an African Union call that Lieutenant Colonel Isaac Zida relinquish military control of the new government. Zida was chosen as prime minister and defense minister. Zida was named last week by the new president, Michel Kafando, who served as foreign minister in the administration of the now deposed president, Blaise Compaoré. Kafando was selected from among five candidates by a committee of leaders of civil society, the political opposition, and the military. Kafando was the military's nominee. In addition to serving as president, Kafando will also serve as foreign minister. Three other military officers have been appointed to the cabinet as well. Neither Kafando nor Zida are eligible to run for president in new constitutional voting in 1 year.
Also, Michel Kafando says he's authorized an investigation to identify the remains of former President Thomas Sankara. Sankara came to power in a military coup in 1983, but was overthrown by another military officer, Blaise Compaoré, 4 years later. Sankara is considered by many Burkinabe to be a folk hero who defended the poor and battled corruption. Ernest Harsh is an adjunct associate professor at Columbia University's School of International and Public Affairs and a research scholar at the university's Institute of African Studies. He told reporter William Eagle that Sankara supporters are influential among young people, the opposition, and even the armed forces.
So the official Sankara's parties, you know, they're recognized parties, they favor multi-party democracy and running in elections, as almost everybody does. And if they have any criticism of the Sankara era, it was that they weren't elections back then. The younger folks have a more of a hodgepodge kind of approach, probably a bit more radical. They might be a bit disdainful of elections that seem to bring into power elite parties. They will also have more of a social and economic agenda that would sort of highlight what they see as the strong points of the Sankara era. You know, that is health care, education for the poorest sectors of the population, favoring the rural poor over the urban elites, advancing women, but also on foreign policy issues, taking sort of at least a mildly anti-imperialist stance as they would view it. So they might be leery of some of Compaoré's past alliances, the extent to which he was close to France or even to, you know, the Pentagon, the U.S. interests in terms of the war on terror. They wouldn't break those kinds of ties, I'm sure, but they would have been a bit critical. Certainly they've been critical of the West in terms of their support for Compaoré and then not saying very much about Compaoré's attempts to manipulate the Constitution to stay in power. People in Burkina, the more radical types, would also be critical of neighboring African governments for not having said very much about Compaoré's manipulations and then coming in immediately after his fall to insist that there be a civilian-led regime. I mean, they're for that. They're for a civilian-led regime, but, you know, it just rankled a bit, some of these outside criticisms after they had brought him down.
Both Sankara and Compaoré came to power in military coups. Does this make it more likely that the military will continue to exercise a perhaps overwhelming influence in the country?
Well, look, from the very beginning of the country's independence, the military has had quite a considerable influence. This was one of the weakest states in West Africa from the outset, and the military was one of the few institutions, here I'm talking about back to the 60s, that had any kind of sort of national scope. The military came in first in 1966 against an unpopular civilian regime with popular support. So it wasn't just Sankara and Compaoré came out of the military. Many previous presidents came out of the military. The differences between Sankara and Compaoré is Sankara came in with considerable popular support in alliance with civilians. Compaoré basically engineered a military coup that, you know, led with the assassination of Sankara. So he was unpopular at the outset. Since then, yes, a constitutional system has been erected. You know, the institutions were created. You had a parliament. You had a, you know, series of supreme courts, judicial system. You even had the army expanding to some extent. In all those institutions, you had professionals, people who sort of wanted to take the institution and do with it what they're supposed to do. But it was people around Compaoré, his family, and the ruling party who often would pervert that process or try to. And I think, you know, sort of a little bit the hope for the future is that in combination with the obvious mobilization of people in the streets, these more professional types in the courts, in the military, will finally see an opportunity to get those institutions to function the way they're supposed to.
And what challenges do you see facing this transition?
Expectations are very high. There's a lot of economic and social demands. The country is very poor. There was a big visible gap in wealth between people who are close to the regime and ordinary people. So there's a strong sentiment. I mean, labor certainly would want to have salary increases. I don't know if they'll press right away, but, you know, that's been a standard demand because salaries have lagged behind the rise in high prices. Students have their own grievances. Local communities have all sorts of disputes. We've already seen a few conflicts emerging around some of the foreign mining concessions in different parts of the country, where residents in those areas, you know, felt the foreign mining companies were being a bit negligent on environmental standards, you know, dumping toxic waste and stuff like that. So they've occupied a few of these mining sites. There's a lot of, you know, discontent. Things like that, if they're not properly managed, you know, if the authorities don't make some attempt to at least listen to the grievances, could get, you know, cause some problems.
That was Professor Ernest Harsh of Columbia University's School of International and Public Affairs. He was speaking with reporter William Eagle.
Gambia is the latest African country to toughen its laws against homosexuality. In October, President Yahya Jammeh approved a new crime called aggravated homosexuality, but the action was not publicly announced at the time. Rights groups such as Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch called the law homophobic. They say it will lead to greater abuses. François Patouel is the West Africa campaigner at Amnesty International. From Dakar, Senegal, he spoke to VOA's Jody Kapua about the new Gambian crime of aggravated homosexuality.
The code itself is extremely vague, which means that it could be used, you know, in a very broad manner to penalize people on the basis of their sexual orientation and their gender identity. The law is extremely broad. Some examples of people that would fit the category of aggravated homosexuality under Gambian law are people who are having sex with people who have HIV/AIDS or people who are having sex with people who have disabilities. So it's an extremely broad law which further criminalizes homosexuality in the Gambia and which could be used to arrest people on the basis of their sexual orientation and their gender identity. The international and regional human rights standards are very clear on this matter. No one should be arrested, intimidated, harassed in any way based on their sexual orientation or their gender identity.
Now, President Yahya Jammeh apparently approved this back on October 9th, and yet it was not uncovered until some documents were found in mid-November. Why was that?
There's been a clear lack of transparency from the Gambian authorities with regards to the evolution of the status of the law. They were specifically questioned by the UK, for instance, at the United Nations around the status of the law. And the Minister of Justice, who was representing Gambia at the Universal Periodic Review back in October, failed to acknowledge that the law had been passed.
Would you tell me about some of the new penalties that are now in effect?
In Gambia, homosexuality was criminalized since 2005, and that offense was carrying a 14-year sentence in prison. With the introduction of the crime of aggravated homosexuality, this sentence is increased to life imprisonment. And we are extremely concerned that it could be used against people that have been arrested in recent weeks. There's been a wave of arrests in recent weeks in Gambia, at least 8 people since the 7th of November. And there is a very strong concern that the aggravated homosexuality offense could be used against them and that they could face life imprisonment solely for being perceived to be gay or perceived to be lesbians.
So they've been arrested. Have you heard of any charges actually being filed yet?
No, they have not been charged. Some of them have been detained for now more than 2 weeks, and they haven't been charged or brought to a court of law. They haven't been able to talk to a lawyer or to talk to their relatives either. Some of them have been released and were able to talk to their relatives upon their release, but during their detention, they were neither charged or able to talk to a lawyer. They mention a cell which is quite large, where both the women that were perceived to be lesbians and the men who were perceived to be gays were held together, including with a 17-year-old boy, in complete darkness, so they could not see each other, and what they described as a foul smell because there was no toilet facilities in the cells that they were kept in. They were threatened of rape, so outrageous human rights violations there. What's interesting with the Criminal Code Amendment Act of 2014, which introduced aggravated homosexuality in the Gambia, is it's actually copy-pasted from the Uganda bill criminalizing homosexuality. So we can see that there is state-sponsored homophobia in quite a few countries in the region, particularly in Gambia, where it comes from the top, comparing homosexuality to malaria, for instance, and saying that gays should be treated like mosquitoes.
François Patouel is the West Africa campaigner at Amnesty International. From Dakar, Senegal, he spoke to VOA's Jody Kapua.
Nineteen minutes past the hour. This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Somali militant group Al-Shabaab is denying Kenya's claim that its forces have killed more than 100 Al-Shabaab fighters. Kenya says it launched raids along the Somali border after Al-Shabaab attacked a bus in northeastern Kenya, killing 28 people. As Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi, there is anger towards the government for failing to protect Kenyans from the militants.
Pressure is mounting on the Kenyan government to provide evidence that its forces killed more than 100 al-Shabaab militants operating along the Kenya-Somalia border, including those behind a deadly attack on a bus on Saturday. Police in northeastern Kenya and witnesses say gunmen ambushed the bus and killed 28 non-Muslims who were singled out from the 60 passengers. Al-Shabaab claimed responsibility for the attack, saying it was retaliation for recent raids Kenyan security forces carried out on mosques in Mombasa. In an address to the nation Sunday, Deputy President William Ruto said Kenyan forces have carried out operations targeting the militant group's fighters and a training camp in southern Somalia.
Two successful operations in the hideout of the perpetrators of the Mandera executions were swiftly carried out across the border. Our retaliatory action left in its trail more than 100 fatalities. It also destroyed 4 technicals and the camp from which this crime was planned.
In a statement, Al-Shabaab said none of its forces have been killed and said Kenya's assertion was baseless and unfounded. The group further said Kenyan officials are trying to cover up their failure to provide security. Kenya has witnessed a series of deadly attacks over the last 3 years, ever since it sent troops into Somalia to fight Al-Shabaab. The deadliest was the assault on a Nairobi shopping mall in September 2013 that left more than 70 people dead. Ahead of this latest attack, Mandera Governor Ali Roba shared an intelligence report with security agencies that said there was increased Al-Shabaab activity near the border and the group was planning to carry out more attacks. The governor said his warnings were not heeded and no actions were taken.
About 2 weeks ago, I shared grave concerns about increased terror activities along our borders, which were downplayed and termed to us the governor was politicking. It's better to respond to every intel that you get and find nothing than fail to respond with information and put the country to sleep.
Kenya's police chief has denied receiving intelligence about the attack or terror threats. Visiting families who lost loved ones in Saturday's attack, opposition leader and former Prime Minister Raila Odinga called for an overhaul of the security apparatus and for the government to stop paying lip service in matters of security.
It's no evidence that people have been killed, that the camp that they bombed may have been empty. Those people would have been stupid to go back into their camps. So we want to tell the Vice President that the time for theatrics has run out.
That's right.
We are tired of you coming to the screens or TV to tell Kenyans, oh, action is going to be taken. We will hunt them. We will find them. They cannot hide. They have hidden from last year.
Al-Shabaab does not have a base in Kenya, but has vowed it will continue to carry out attacks so long as Kenyan troops are still in Somalia. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Thank you, Mohammed. Escalating food prices, poor rains, and armed conflict may be the perfect storm for another famine to hit Somalia in the coming months. However, a Nairobi-based NGO is teaching Somalis and other Horn of Africa neighbors that history does not have to repeat itself. Dagan Ali is the executive director of African Development Solutions, ADESO, an NGO that works in the Horn of Africa. The development group empowers Africans caught in the crosshairs of war, famine, and poverty. Its goal is for Africans to take care of themselves without always relying on global aid. She spoke with me about the challenges Somalis are facing and how they can overcome them through programs such as Cash for Work.
I think that one of the biggest challenges, as you just mentioned rightly, is hunger. So the famine, while it's not an officially a famine condition right now, there are serious humanitarian concerns, particularly for those in southern Somalia who are victims to the conflict and communities that are basically feeling the negative impact and consequences of an active conflict and food prices that are being impacted or don't have access to food because of the conflict. So those are one of our biggest concerns and one of the biggest challenges that people are facing.
Your organization offers a Cash for Work program. How does this work?
Well, ADESO pioneered cash transfers in Somalia and Africa in general, We are the first documented NGO to have undertaken cash transfers. It's because we believe that people have a diverse needs, just like you and I. They don't have just a food need. They have also a water need. They have a shelter need. They have a health need. And cash transfers gives them the options, the flexibility to basically provide for themselves and their children beyond just the food aid that's given. So when you have a sack of grain or cereal that's given to you in the form of food aid, you're not able to fulfill all these other diverse needs. You're only able to fulfill your food need. So the cash transfers provides a lot of flexibility in that instance. And ADESA has been implementing cash transfers as the most effective transfer to vulnerable households in the Horn of Africa now for over 10 years.
Why have these types of programs, the cash-based programs, why do some people consider them controversial?
I think it's lack of information. Transfers have been proven, both humanitarian cash transfers and longer-term social protection. Cash transfers have now been proven to really lift people out of poverty, as it's been proven in Latin America, particularly in the case of Brazil, in the case of Somalia and Kenya. All the studies have shown that people are really using their small transfer for the best purposes. They are making very critical decisions around food, health, water, and those kinds of immediate needs, very basic survival needs. So I think there's this fear of letting go of control and giving them control from you, the donor, to the individual who's being impacted. And I think we all know that as individuals, no matter whether we're in Somalia or whether we're in Washington, D.C., we would like to be given some level of control and ability to make decisions about what we need at that time, and especially considering that they're diverse.
What can the people of Somalia do now to prevent famine and also to reduce their dependence on international aid?
Actually, Somalis are the most resilient community. They've been in conflict and in war conditions without effective government for almost 25 years. And in that time period, yes, we've had a famine where 260,000 people have died, but they've also have survived quite a lot. One of the forms of resiliency that Somalis have is remittances. So actually, there is more remittance that comes into Somalia from families supporting each other who work in the region or abroad than there is in humanitarian aid. Conservative estimates is $1.3 billion comes into Somalia in the form of remittances. And these are from relatives, and these are Somalis really helping themselves. While international humanitarian aid at the worst time of the crisis didn't even reach $1 billion. That was during the famine. In normal years, it might reach $500 million. So the Somalis proportionally are contributing more towards themselves and towards each other than the international aid system is.
That was Dagan Ali, executive director of the Nairobi-based NGO African Development Solutions, ADESO. She spoke with me from Washington.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Hayes Wuhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
This is a public service announcement from VOA Africa. U.S. President Barack Obama addressing the Ebola crisis.
Ebola is actually a difficult disease to catch. It's not transmitted through the air like the flu. You cannot get it from just riding on a plane or a bus. The only way that a person can contract the disease is by coming into direct contact with the bodily fluids of somebody who is already showing symptoms. We know how to fight this disease. We know the protocols. And we know that when they're followed, they work. And if we take the steps that are necessary, if we're guided by the science, the facts, not fear, then I'm absolutely confident that we can prevent a serious outbreak here in the United States, and we can continue to lead the world in this urgent effort.
This was a public service announcement from VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Somali militant group Al-Shabaab denies Kenya's claim that its forces have killed more than 100 Al-Shabaab fighters. Escalating food prices, poor rains, and armed conflict may be the perfect storm for another famine to hit Somalia in the coming months. And Burkina Faso's military holds on to powerful post in a new cabinet unveiled yesterday. Coming up, we have music from Cameroon, and in our feature segment, finding ways to help reduce maternal mortality rates in Kenya. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehias Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports is next. Of course, it's time now for the sunny side of sports with the mighty, mighty Douglas Mpuga, sitting in for Sonny Young this week. And hello, Douglas.
Hello, Kim.
What's on tap today?
Well, Kim, we'll kick off with athletics in Africa.
Okay.
Thank you. We begin in Addis Ababa, where the 2014 Great Ethiopian Run 10 kilometer was held on Sunday. Wude Ayalewe and Asmara Bakele, both past winners of the event, won the men's and women's races respectively. Ayalewe became the first athlete in the race's 14-year history to win three titles, having triumphed previously in 2008 and 2009. Bakele, who had won in 2010, returned to win his second title to make it two wins out of two, having missed the three intervening races. The winning times for both the men's and the women's races were among the slowest in the race's history, 30:12 for Bakele and 34:04 for Ayalewe, but were expected given the tough nature of the course, which included three steep climbs over the final 4 kilometers. The race finished almost on top of a hill at the Jana Meda race course, as the traditional finishing location of Maskela Square was unavailable. In football, all is set for the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations in Equatorial Guinea. From Lagos, Nigeria, Nightline Africa's Shegun on the dot at DMA has the rundown. Hello, Shegun.
Good evening, Douglas, and good evening, Africa. It is now 54 days to the kickoff of the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations. The 2015 tournament will be the 30th edition of the two-yearly football extravaganza. After Morocco backed out from hosting the tournament due to Ebola fears, African soccer's governing body, CAF, gave the hosting rights to Equatorial Guinea. The 2015 tournament will mark the second time that Equatorial Guinea will play host to the tournament. The country co-hosted with Gabon the 2012 edition, which was won by Zambia. Well, all the 16 finalists for next year's tournament have now emerged after the conclusion of the qualifiers last Wednesday. Joining host Equatorial Guinea in the finals are Algeria, Burkina Faso, Cameroon, Cape Verde, Congo-Brazzaville, Democratic Republic of Congo, Gabon, Ghana, Guinea, Ivory Coast, Mali, Senegal, South Africa, Tunisia, and Zambia. Conspicuously missing from the list is Nigeria, which is the current African champion. Nigeria needed to beat South Africa in their final group qualifier on Wednesday to pick the tickets to the finals. However, it could only manage a draw, which means it will not be traveling to Equatorial Guinea for the finals. For a quick perspective on Nigeria's failure to reach the finals, I spoke with Vincent Tobi, a Nigerian sports analyst.
What is your take on the fact that the African champion will not be defending his title at the Africa Cup of Nations next year?
My take is very simple. They got what they deserved. Shoddy preparation, neglect for the other teams or the opponents. And when we lost to Congo at home, best deal for us. That's my take on that.
Okay, now that Nigeria is out, this is like the culmination of the state of the football affairs in this country. Where do we go from here? What would you advise the football authorities to do to build a strong Super Eagles team?
First and foremost, I think our coaches will have to go for training. If we insist on not taking foreign coaches, then they have to prepare a program, a training program for our local coaches, so that I'm sure in the last 2-3 years, no local coach in Nigeria has gone for any training abroad. So that is the result we're getting. I think the NFF, that's the Football Federation, will have to go back to the drawing board and try and organize good training programs for our local coaches. Otherwise, let them go for a foreign coach. So that's what I think they should do before they can start building a very good Super Eagles.
That was Vincent Obi, a Nigerian sports analyst. He spoke with me on telephone from Lagos on Nigeria's failure to reach the finals of the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations. Many thanks, Vincent. One team that made it to Equatorial Guinea, despite all the odds, is Guinea. Guinea is one of the three countries in West Africa that are most affected by the Ebola virus disease. Over 1,000 Guineans have so far died of the virus. Because of the disease, Guinea had to play its home games in the qualifying series at a neutral venue, Morocco. Morocco allowed the Stili Nationale, as the Guinean team is known, to play its home games in Casablanca, but the players had to undergo temperature checks twice daily. Guinea coach Michel Dussuyer, however, thanked Morocco, which allowed his team to play its qualifiers in Casablanca and Benin, where the team held training camps. Guinea now needs to find a training venue for 2 weeks in January, before the start of the tournament. Meanwhile, CAF says it is reopening media accreditation process for the final draw of the tournament. The process, which started last Thursday, will round off on November 27th. CAF says the media accreditation was reopened following the announcement of Equatorial Guinea as the new host of the 2015 tournament. The final draw for the 16 qualified teams will be held on December 3rd in Malabo, Equatorial Guinea. In a related development, Egypt has sacked coach Shoki Garib for failing to qualify the country for the 2015 Nations Cup. Egypt missed out on the finals in Equatorial Guinea when a 2-1 defeat in Tunisia on Wednesday left it out of contention for the third-best-placed team. The 55-year-old Garib, who won the tournament as a player in 1986, was appointed in 2013, replacing American Bob Bradley. Egypt is the most successful team at the Nations Cup, having won the title 7 times. Back here in Nigeria, Habu Gumel was elected president of the Nigeria Olympic Committee, NOC, on Thursday. Gumel polled 19 votes to defeat incumbent Sani Ndanusa, who got 17 votes. Finally, Lionel Messi broke the Spanish league's all-time scoring record on Saturday. He surpasses the previous 251-goal mark by scoring a hat-trick in Barcelona's 5-1 defeat of Sevilla. Athletic Bilbao's Telmo Zara set the milestone in 271 La Liga games from 1940 to 1955. Playing in his 298th league match, the 27-year-old Messi first equaled Zara's record in the 21st minute and then beat it in the 72nd. The Argentine went on to get his third goal in the 78th minute, marking his 253rd league goal. Messi's latest scoring feat comes after he equaled Raul Gonzalez as the Champions League's all-time scorer with 71 goals this month. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos. Now sending it back to Douglas the Mighty Umpuga in Washington.
Thank you, Segun. Nightline Africa's Segun on the Dot Adeyemi reporting from Lagos.
Right now, you're listening to the sunny side of sport, so check it out.
Now let's join Daybreak Africa's Marco Woman in Johannesburg, South Africa, for more sports news.
We begin at the Global Watch Summit in Johannesburg, South Africa. The two-day summit, which ended on Friday, set out to mobilize sports people, fans and other stakeholders to create a global movement aimed at ending racism and discrimination in sports. The American Professional Basketball League, NBA, which has attracted almost a third of their best players from outside the country, is a firm believer in zero tolerance for racism. NBA's Amadou Fall explains.
What matters is really the talent and the makeup of your character. At the NBA, if you've got game, we want you in our league. And we are going to make sure that you are successful. As a global brand and also looking at the popularity and the visibility of our players, we understand that we have a responsibility to be leaders in really leading the conversations on social issues. This is why when incidents happen, we don't hide. We act swiftly and decisively.
That was Senegal's Amadou Fall, the NBA representative at the Global Watch Summit, speaking in Johannesburg, South Africa. Meanwhile, the International Olympic Committee president, Thomas Bach, emphasized the Olympic movement's firm rejection of racism in sports. He explains.
The Olympic movement was founded by Baron Pierre de Coubertin on the belief that sport should stand for understanding, respect and dialogue. He made it clear when he stated that sport is for everyone, without distinction of birth, caste, fortune, position, or profession. There is no place for racism in sport. Sport stands for building bridges, never for erecting walls. That the global diversity of cultures, societies, and life designs is a source of richness. The Olympic Games are the culmination of this message of non-discrimination and unity in diversity.
That was Thomas Bach, the International Olympic Committee president, speaking in Johannesburg, South Africa.
Thanks, Mark. And finally, in boxing, Manny Pacquiao retained his WBO welterweight title in Macau on Sunday. The Filipino 8-weight world champion knocked down and beaten American challenger Chris Aligiri six times during the 12-round contest. Now the 35-year-old wants to strike a deal to finally meet a 5-weight world champion, Floyd Mayweather. Filipino Pacquiao and American Mayweather, who is 37, are widely considered the best fighters of their generation but have never fought. Against Aligiri, Pacquiao registered his 57th win from 64 bouts. And that's it for this edition of the Sunnyside Sports. I'm Douglas Impoga. Now back to you, Kim.
Thank you, Douglas, and listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Douglas will have an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, finding ways to help reduce maternal mortality rates in Kenya. And next, a cell phone app to help women avoid unwanted pregnancies in Cameroon. But first, some music. Here is Dr. Musika of Cameroon with King of Pop.
Thank you.
Michael Jackson. Samusa. Mama ko, mama sa, mama ko. Mama ko, mama sa, mama ko sa. Mama ko, mama sa, mama ko. Mama ko, mama sa, mama ko sa. Mama ko, mama sa, mama ko sa. Mama ko, mama sa, mama ko sa.
Cameroon's Dr. Muzika with King of Pop.
Yes, what a tribute to Michael Jackson. Well, the wheelbarrow ambulance in Nairobi's largest informal settlement, Kibera, has been modified to assist pregnant women to get to medical facilities faster, reducing maternal mortality rates in the process. Lenny Rubaga reports from Nairobi.
This is Laini Saba in Kibera, Kenya's largest informal settlement, with more than 500,000 residents. Most of the shanties that dot the area lack basic amenities such as electricity, toilets and water. 7 years ago, in a bid to bring quality medical care to locals, African Medical Research Foundation, or AMREF Kenya, began the Kibera Community Health Center, serving more than 50,000 residents. One of AMREF's flagship programs is the Stand Up for African Mothers campaign to reduce maternal mortality. Angeline Agina is one of the beneficiaries of this campaign. The 28-year-old mother of one religiously keeps her prenatal checkups at 23 weeks pregnant, thanks to subsidies from AMREF that her $100 a month income could stretch to cover. Another hallmark of the AMREF program is the wheelbarrow ambulance for women in labor who live in remote parts of Kibera. Agina says she is not worried now when the time comes to give birth.
The wheelbarrow ambulance is actually good because cars and conventional ambulances cannot access my house. Once I go into labor, the wheelbarrow can be here in minutes to take me to the clinic.
AMREF has four modified wheelbarrow ambulances, which cost $100 each, yet serve nearly 10,000 expectant mothers here. Meet Wycliffe Ogenya, working here from Kenya's Ministry of Health. Today, he's paying Agina a special visit to check on her pregnancy and conduct a simulation run with the wheelbarrow ambulance. The ambulance is fitted with a battery-powered siren and bedding to make the ride more comfortable along Kibera's harsh and bumpy terrain. Ogenya says part of his role is to help Kenya meet the United Nations Millennium Development Goals in the healthcare arena.
I am in charge of 2,500 households. My role entails promoting health at the household level, and one of the aspects we are looking at is the MDG number 5, which talks of improving maternal health. Now, in this case, we are looking at mothers who are expectant, and we are ensuring that they have institutional deliveries.
In 2010, about 162,000 women died in sub-Saharan Africa during pregnancy and childbirth for lack of simple, affordable medical care. At the current rate of progress in sub-Saharan Africa, the MDG to reduce child mortality will not be met until 2165, and the goal to improve maternal health is desperately off track. For Agina, though, and other expectant mothers, the wheelbarrow brigade and the healthcare that comes along with it has greatly improved their chances of a healthy delivery. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi.
Okay. Cameroon has become the seventh African country to begin using the Calculator 28, a program that calculates female ovulation to help women avoid unwanted pregnancies. The Calculator 28 can be used via mobile phone or as a kit. Moki Edwin Kenzeka has more from Yaounde.
Belinda Yayin was just 15 years old when she got pregnant last year. She says she wasn't prepared to have a baby or the stigma that comes with being an unwed schoolgirl.
I don't even want to remember what happened. I gave birth, and 2 days after, I was sent back home with no follow-up of what was happening to my child. The child got sick and passed away. I'm almost traumatized because of this act.
Belinda is one of the estimated 222 million women in developing countries the World Health Organization says would like to delay or stop childbearing but are not using any method of contraception. Tackling the issue, Gabonese-born Paul Frank Injinjet Gunjut came up with a new tool to help women better understand their bodies and fertility.
40% of girls and women don't know how to calculate their menstrual cycle. And also, one-third women have the first babies before 18 years old.
He developed the Calculator 28 to pinpoint ovulation, the fertile time in a woman's monthly cycle.
People who use our application have to send a message with the date of last menstruation and the duration of period, and they will receive the date of next menstruation, the fertile period, and the date of ovulation.
Gynecologist Tumasang Florence of the Yaounde Central Hospital says this tool can have a huge impact in Africa, where there is great need to give more information about and control to women over their bodies.
L'importance de ce projet, c'est parce qu'on a des problèmes de planning familial. La plupart des femmes.
She says Africa has serious family planning problems. A majority of women do not even know what a menstrual cycle is, and 40% of those who do know are not capable of remembering the last date of their menses, leading to unwanted pregnancies. While Calculator 28 is SMS-based, it can also be distributed as a kit that can show women without mobile phones how to calculate their menstrual cycle and receive information on their fertile and unsafe periods for sexual intercourse. Paul Frank Injinjet Gunjut says his project is off to a good start, but he'd like to raise the funds to distribute this Africa-wide.
This appliance is already open in Gabon, in Senegal, Burkina Faso, Ivory Coast, Cameroon, and we hope in the near time in all around in Africa. We need money to create the physical kit to give in the rural area. We need money to give this tools for our population.
Women are not the only ones interested in Calculator 28. So are some men.
Quand je vois la réaction du ministre de l'enseignement supérieur, le ministre de l'enseignement des enseignements secondaires, le ministre de l'éducation de base.
Eugene Paul Ndama says he did not plan 4 of his wife's 9 pregnancies and he wishes they had such a tool. He says Calculator 28 could be a blessing for many schools and communities too to help young people prevent pregnancy before they are ready to handle it. Paul Frank Injinjet Gunjut says as UN member states begin to prepare their post-millennium development next year, more focus should be on family planning. He notes a recent UN report shows that without a better strategy, 40% of the 2 billion children to be born in Africa before 2035 would come from unwanted pregnancies. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaounde.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Greg Burns, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Leaders of the world's 20 largest economies, the so-called G20 nations, met recently in Australia to increase cooperation on addressing serious global issues ranging from poverty to climate change. They also took up West Africa's Ebola epidemic, agreeing to coordinate a stronger response to the crisis. Attending heads of state said they were committed to do what is necessary to ensure a coordinated international effort to stem the outbreak and address its medium-term economic and humanitarian costs. They also urged the World Bank and International Monetary Fund to continue their strong support for the affected countries and welcomed an IMF initiative to provide another $300 million in medical and economic aid. The United States is a leading member of the G20, and it's fully committed to the initiative. We are also partnering with the United Nations and other international partners to aid in the crisis, and have issued a call to action to the private sector. Hundreds of millions of dollars have been raised from individuals, nonprofits, and others, providing critical assistance in the international response. Many areas of great need remain, however. A full range of U.S. government agencies is increasing assistance to the affected countries and their citizens, international organizations, and non-governmental groups. This includes medical teams, equipment, and other essential supplies, and public health messaging efforts. The United States is also supporting public education and outreach campaigns in the region, reaching some of the most remote areas with life-saving information on how to identify, treat, and prevent Ebola. These messages are being conveyed through radio, text, newspapers, and word of mouth. President Obama and the U.S. government as a whole also have a comprehensive strategy to prevent any transmission of the disease in the United States. As the president has noted, stopping the epidemic at its source, in West Africa, is the only way to end the Ebola threat. West Africa is facing the largest, most devastating Ebola outbreak in history. We are fully committed to the coordinated global effort that is needed to stop this epidemic and help the affected countries recover.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.
All out of love. Right here at the VOA Africa. Keep it locked. VOA Africa. Don't miss.
Hello, Africa. This is James Butte, host of Voice of America's Daybreak Africa. Join me Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC for the latest in African news, features, and sports. We are also available on the internet at www.voaafrica.com. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show on the Voice of America.